This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. All 184 members agree that the mission of the World Bank is simple, to fight global poverty. How best to do that is a bit more contentious. Created in 1944, the World Bank provides loans to developing countries for a variety of projects, schools, roads, AIDS prevention. The institution is based in Washington, D.C. By tradition, its president is the nominee of the United States. And over the years, critics say that this international agency has sometimes been used as a tool of American foreign policy. And that's a major concern now, following the election of Paul Wolfowitz as president of the World Bank 2 weeks ago. His previous job was Deputy Secretary of Defense. He's regarded as the intellectual architect of the war in Iraq. In a conversation with Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour, Wolfowitz said he knew his nomination would be controversial.
Oh, yes, no question about it. I think a lot of it has to do with the controversies about the war, and frankly, some of it has to do with caricature, but we can put that behind us. I think the other thing is, for some people, and I think it's been a learning process on both sides for the last few weeks, because I've been so associated with one policy, I don't think people sufficiently appreciated that I believe deeply in the mission of the bank, that poverty reduction and economic development is something I've been close to in a number of points in my career, particularly when I was American ambassador to Indonesia, and before that when I was working closely with the Philippines and the State Department. And you know, I think if we want to achieve the vision of the future that I think all of us dream of, not just for Americans but for the whole world, there are a number of pieces that have to fit together, and reducing poverty has got to be one of the major pieces, and this is the institution that has the biggest responsibility in that area.
As the World Bank prepares for its spring meeting here in Washington this weekend, the agenda includes debt relief and anti-corruption initiatives, but most interest will be focused on the controversial president-elect. Later in the program, a judge in Louisiana says he cannot force the state to pay for public defenders, but he will stop prosecutions unless there's an adequate defense. And a newly discovered poem by a young Tennessee Williams. But first, the future of the World Bank under Paul Wolfowitz. If you have questions about how the World Bank works, give us a phone call. Is promotion of democracy part of its mission? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're joined here in Studio 3A by Sebastian Mallaby, a Washington Post columnist, author of The World's Banker, A Story of Failed States, Financial Crises, and The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. Nice of you to join us today.
Good to be here.
And with us by phone from New York City is Joseph Stiglitz. He's the former chief economist for the World Bank, now a professor of finance and economics at Columbia University and a Nobel Prize winner in economics. Nice to have you on the program as well.
Good to be here.
Paul Wolfowitz is known to favor the ideology of democracy. Is that going to be a problem with him at the World Bank, Joseph Stiglitz?
It could. The charter of the World Bank says that it's not supposed to focus on political but economic issues. But I'm not sure that those two can be separated. And obviously, in the past, they've become intermingled. Issues like privatization are political. The question is really where you draw the boundary.
And obviously his nomination was controversial, as we heard a reaction from Europe. Nevertheless, eventually they went along.
That's right. This is a longstanding tradition, one which in a way is contrary to the very notion of democracy. The World Bank is a international public institution, and we're used to thinking about how public institutions make decisions like this. They look for the most qualified person, regardless of race, nationality, gender, religion. And yet this, the most important international institution focused on poverty, goes about its business in an old boys kind of framework. The United States gets to choose the head, not even subject to Senate confirmation. Really a throwback into days of colonialism when the developing countries had no say.
Sebastian Mallaby, some have said that one of the things that President-elect Wolfowitz needs to deal with, obviously there are a lot of challenges facing the World Bank, but one of them is the transparency of the election of its own president.
I have a slightly different take on that, actually. I mean, my feeling is that the international system tends to work when the United States leads it. There is no mechanism for reaching decisions. If you just make it all democratic and say all 184 countries get an equal say, and if you want proof of that, just look at the UN General Assembly and how that doesn't function. Even a less democratic version, like the UN Security Council, where you've got five permanent members, they often split 2-3 or 4-1 or whatever. And so if you actually want to have decisions and effective action on behalf of the world's poor, driven by the World Bank, there is in fact a case to be made for saying, look, you know, by having the US choose the president, in my view it shouldn't always be a US candidate, but nonetheless the US having the power to choose, you concentrate power in the major shareholder, which will then use the bank constructively to drive an enlightened foreign policy, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Joseph Stiglitz, some have said that along with the nomination of John Bolt to be the new ambassador to the United Nations, the Wolfowitz nomination, obviously he has gone through, is now president-elect of the World Bank, but that was sort of a the Bush administration of sticking it in the eye of old Europe.
I'm not sure about that. The interesting thing is about Wolfowitz is that he's had a long-standing interest in developing countries. He was ambassador to Indonesia. He was the head of Johns Hopkins SAIS, the School of International Affairs. So it isn't apparent that it was doing that. Obviously, the process was unsatisfactory, and the history, his involvement with Iraq, certainly raises questions. I think the real test is going to come going forward. Where will he stand on a number of issues where the interest, I believe, of the international community, the interest of the World Bank, differ markedly from where the Bush administration has previously taken a stand.
Mm-hmm. Sebastian Mallaby, again, over the years, the World Bank has been charged from time to time of being an instrument of American foreign policy. Given what you said earlier about its need to work closely with the U.S. government, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I mean, the first point is that it's an inevitable thing, and it's been true through different administrations, so that in the 1980s in the Cold War, the World Bank was used, you know, to back up Cold War allies who were not reducing poverty at all, like Mobutu and Zaire is the most notorious example. Then in the 1990s, the Clinton administration also used the World Bank, partly to prop up allies like Boris Yeltsin, because they believed in the democratization in Russia, partly also to do things like the reconstruction of Bosnia in 1995-1996, partly also to help bail out Asian countries during the financial crisis. So it's been true during the 90s as well, under both, therefore, Democratic and Republican administrations, that the bank is bound up with American policy. And I would say, in fact, that the world is sometimes better off. I mean, in the preparation for the Iraq War, it would have been very nice if the Pentagon, by the way, the Pentagon including Paul Wolfowitz, had consulted the World Bank more on how to do post-war reconstruction in Iraq, and it failed to reach out to the experts of the World Bank who had done East Timor, Kosovo, Bosnia, who had experience of how to do this reconstruction. And by not reaching out, I think the U.S. policy was a lot worse.
I agree with that. The real question is, the United States has now adopted a set of, advocated certain policies like in Iraq, the kind of shock therapy that failed so miserably in Russia, instant liberalization, privatization of everything except the oil companies. The question is, will now he adopt allow the bank to advocate policies which are contrary to the clearly failed policies that the United States has pursued in Iraq on reconstruction. That would be one example where I think would be a test of whether he is simply an advocate of the administration or he's really taken on a role as an international civil servant.
There is an irony here, though, I think, which I've tried to tease Professor Stiglitz about before, and I'll try again now, which is that the right-wing policies of an earlier version were essentially to define development as the Washington Consensus, a kind of privatization, markets-only sort of view of development. And along came, you know, important thinkers of the left, not least Professor Stiglitz, who, when he was chief economist at the World Bank, was arguing for a broader, more textured, more political understanding of what makes development work. And now in comes Paul Wolfowitz, and looking at his background and his record, not only in Indonesia, where he supported giving some development money to the opposition to Suharto, but also in before that in the Philippines, where he was involved in the overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos. He's a person who has a strong interest in democratization, has a strong interest in the political underpinnings of development, and in fact, Wolfowitz may be the man to implement the Stiglitz agenda at the World Bank.
Well, that would be interesting, and I would obviously welcome that. There are some other issues where I think the Bush administration's position is different from the interest of the bank and the international community more broadly. For instance, one of the G7, G8 agreed in their last meeting a couple months ago that there should be debt relief of up to 100% of existing debt. There was consensus, except for the United States, that the World Bank's share ought to be paid for by the G7, by the rich countries, not out of the capital of the World Bank, because doing that would, in effect, have the poor countries pay for the poorest. The United States was the one holdout. I hope that he will support the bank's position, that is to say, try to argue that the G7, the rich countries, should be paying for this debt relief. And it may be that another example where he might be able to help, because of his standing in the Bush administration, he might actually be able to move them on this critical issue.
We're talking today with Joseph Stiglitz, a former chief economist at the World Bank, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, and with Sebastian Mallaby of the Washington Post, author of The World's Banker, a story of failed states, financial crises, and the wealth and poverty of nations. When we come back from a break, we'll take your calls on the future of the World Bank under its controversial new president, Paul Wolfowitz. How much, if at all, is democracy part of the mission of the World Bank, which is formally to eradicate poverty? What is the direction the World Bank should go in? Also, if you have questions, basic questions about how this institution came to be created and what it actually does, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just before the spring meeting of the World Bank, we're talking about how this institution helps developing nations and about its future under President-elect Paul Wolfowitz. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Sebastian Mallaby, author of The World's Banker, A Story of Failed States, Financial Crises, and the Wealth and Poverty of Nations, and Joseph Stiglitz, former chief economist at the World Bank. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Ray. Ray's calling us from Reno, Nevada.
Thanks for the show, Neil. My question is on the nature of democratic regimes or democracy. What's the definition? Is that like pro-U.S. Regimes are all democratic regime, or let's say the country has a democratic regime but it's not really necessarily pro-U.S., what would be the World Bank situation in this case? I mean, what would be...
Yeah, does the World Bank, Sebastian Mallaby, measure its clients like that?
Well, I think it has a sophisticated array of measures of different kinds of pluralism, which include, things like economic governance, how efficient that is, how many days it would take you to set up a business. But also there are measures of corruption, which partly work by asking businessmen how much corruption do you feel in these different countries. And so there are an array of measures to kind of look at the quality of governance, to see how good the rule of law is, how level the playing field is, how much freedom you have, both economic and in a sense political too.
But as an international institution, does it openly or behind the scenes say, and what kind of a friend is this?
Well, that's where you get into the Cold War example of supporting dictators like Mobutu in Zaire. That was clearly a case where the US said to the World Bank, you know, prop this guy up, we don't care if he's good or bad for development. And so there are bad and embarrassing examples like that. But on the whole, that's not what the World Bank is doing. And there is a board which consists of all the countries who own a stake in it. The US is the biggest shareholder, but only has something like 16% of the vote. And so it's very difficult for the US to sort of, you know, pursue totally transparently, you know, its own strategy through the World Bank. It doesn't happen very much.
Mm-hmm. And
I think there is a set of subtle influences. There have been some studies done at the IMF, not the World Bank, but the two institutions are parallel, where one academic study done at Harvard looked at relationship between the nature of the aid gotten from the IMF and how close their votes were in accord with the U.S. position at the UN, as sort of a measure of closeness and of political position. And there was a correlation. But I think it is true that it is certainly not crude in the way that it was in earlier periods during the Cold War.
Well, I think the concern, Joseph Stiglitz, is that, countries' positions in the war on terrorism might be now a substitute for that previous Cold War model.
I think that is a concern. Or to put it more generally, those who do the right thing in terms of what U.S. foreign policy wants will get rewarded with more assistance. An example of this kind of view is Pakistan, which when it tested its nuclear bomb was actually suspended for foreign assistance. It is not a democracy, and yet it is receiving an enormous amount of assistance from the United States because of it has been on the, quote, the right side in the war on terrorism. Mm-hmm. So clearly it is a filter that looks at democracy from, you might say, a particular perspective.
Okay, Ray, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Deborah. Deborah's calling us from Akron, Ohio.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, Neil. Thanks for the program today. I would like to ask your guests about the possibility of debt cancellation for Africa. I believe it is on the G7's agenda this spring. And on the issue of more transparent accounting practices, I know that many of the countries that are currently in debt and trying to live with the debt also have very low standards of living and just problems with education and ability to meet healthcare demands, et cetera. And I think there are examples to where debt cancellation has worked when managed with clear, transparent, democratic processes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't you start, Sebastian Mallet?
Sure, I mean, that's right. There's been a progressive series of debt relief initiatives. The first came, at least for the World Bank and the IMF, in 1996, when some debt was forgiven, and then in 1999, a bunch more debt was forgiven. And now there's a lot of pressure, which comes both from European countries, but also from the U.S. Treasury, in favor of further debt relief. And the real issue is, not are we going to do more debt relief, because I think there's a consensus there.
Yes.
It's more who is going to pay for this debt relief. Suppose these countries in Africa or elsewhere, which are really poor and can't afford to pay these debts, if they stop paying for them, does this mean the World Bank just stops receiving the money and therefore has a hole in its balance sheet and can't extend as much new assistance to other countries? Or will the World Bank be compensated by new aid from the US, the Europeans, other rich countries, so that you protect the health of the World Bank at the same time as you forgive the debts of the poor countries?
Yeah, I think Sebastian is exactly right about that. And I think all the countries except the United States have basically lined up on the view that you shouldn't undermine the World Bank, you shouldn't undermine its capacity to lend to and give assistance to the poorest countries, but the money should come from the rich countries. And I hope with the new head that we'll continue to take that position.
Is there a possibility of a controlled release of gold reserves that the IMF and World Bank does hold that would not destabilize the world gold market?
The gold reserves question is really an IMF point, not a World Bank point.
Yes.
And there are technical arguments, I think, on both sides as to whether that's the best way to pay for the debt relief. But I think that's sort of a technical issue. I'm not sure it's really a major European-American clash.
It is an IMF issue. And let me say, the basic thing is that the problem is that they don't value the gold at its current market
right.
value. If they revalue the gold, the balance sheet of the IMF looks much, much stronger, and they could just write off what is owed without having to sell the gold, and their balance sheet would be perfectly strong.
Deborah, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
I did want to ask, in his interview with Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour, there was concern expressed in a question that would Mr. Wolfowitz be devoting the lion's share or a bigger share of World Bank attention to promoting democratic reform in the Middle East, which was, after all, a lot of his intellectual project in the Pentagon. He spoke, Joseph Stiglitz, largely about, he said his friends in Asia remind him all the time about the level of poverty there, but he said the World Bank has a special responsibility for Africa.
I think that is true. And the reason for this is that there has been enormous progress in poverty reduction in Asia. And right now, the largest single locus of poverty is in Africa, and it's getting worse. And because it is getting worse, and it has mixed with some very serious health problems, obviously political problems, it should be a focus of the world's attention.
Mm-hmm. I'm told that the first foreign trip that Wolfowitz makes will be to Africa. But on this idea of focusing assistance to the sort of frontline states in the war on terrorism, there's a funny story about this, actually. The outgoing World Bank president, Jim Wolfensohn, right after 9/11, was trying to mend his relationship with the Bush administration, which was pretty rocky. I mean, Jim Wolfensohn was appointed by Clinton. He was very close to Clinton. Clinton twice celebrated his birthday party at Jim Wolfensohn's home. And so when the new team came in with the Bush administration, you know, he was kind of on the outs. And to get back in, he went into the White House and saw Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, and said, look, you know, you now have a problem, but we have lots of contacts in these countries. You know, we will send missions and we will do projects and we will help you out. We will help your foreign policy. So he was selling the World Bank. That's why I keep on saying it's not a new thing to say the World Bank will be a tool of American foreign policy. This is kind of a reality all the way through. But the kicker in the story is that, you know, Wolfensohn then encouraged the dispatch of these World Bank economists to go visit these frontline states in the war on terror. And the economists came back and said, you know, we've done our assessment, and it's very difficult to do projects in a lot of these countries like Tajikistan or whatever, because they're pretty corrupt. And if we spend money on them, they're not going to use it wisely. And so, in fact, although the bank sent people there, they didn't do more projects there. And I hope that Wolfowitz would again stick up for the professional staff and not allow the money to be spent if it was going to be wasted.
An email question from Michael in Nevada. Could one of the guests address the very real trend of, quote, creating dependence through aid and the possibility that poverty-fighting initiatives by the IMF and the World Bank may be misguided due to the imposition of Western economic paradigms on traditional cultures? And I'll throw that one at the Nobel Prize winner.
Well, I think there has been a problem in the past of imposing, you might call it the Washington Consensus model, which is a model which focuses on privatization, liberalization, price stability, not employment stability, not the stability of growth. It's a very narrow view on the of how to run the economy. The most successful economies around the world, in the developing world, have been in East Asia, and they followed quite markedly different set of economic policies. And I think it is a mistake for the World Bank and the IMF to impose that particular doctrine. One of the big advances during President Wolfensohn's tenure, the last 10 years at the World Bank, is that the World Bank has moved very far from this set of doctrines. Its official position now is to say, let the country be in the driver's seat, and has been engaged in trying to have active dialogues on what are the appropriate policies for each particular country. And some countries, it has actually said, you know, privatization is not right for you at this juncture, in this particular sector. So there's a major change in the World Bank, and I hope that those changes are not reversed.
Would in any of those structures the World Bank be saying, well, democracy may not be right for you?
I think that I would be very surprised if they ever said that. But they may say that this is not the issue on which we want to focus at the current time. Our major mission is reducing poverty. Our mission is not largely a political one. Sometimes it is important to it is important in general, for instance, to talk about corruption, because corruption does affect growth, poverty reduction, where the money is going. So you can't separate politics from economics. But on the other hand, there are countries that have not been, you might call, full democracies in the way we would talk about it, which have done a fantastic job of reducing poverty.
We're talking with Joseph Stiglitz, the former chief economist for the World Bank, now a professor of finance and economics at Columbia University, and with Washington Post columnist and author on the World Bank, Sebastian Mallaby, about the future of that institution. It holds its spring meeting here in Washington, D.C. this weekend with the normal attendant demonstrations. But obviously the focus this year is on the new president-elect, Paul Wolfowitz. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Kirill joins us from Boise, Idaho.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about earlier justification for U.S. leadership role in the World Bank. And I think the statement was that it's more effective to have a enlightened sort of dictator in our institution, and which will result in more effective policies. And my question is, what recourse do other members have when those policies dictated by the leader become less enlightened? And the example that comes to mind are the AIDS-fighting efforts in Africa. And I believe there was a recent report stating that U.S. policy tying financial aid to birth control efforts that do not include
abstinence, I think, is the word you're looking for.
Yeah, abstinence. Thank you. Abstinence-only programs have detrimental effect to the health efforts in Africa.
Well, why don't you take that, Sebastian Mallaby?
Sure. I mean, I think the area of AIDS is a good illustration of the way that there's a limit to how much U.S. policy influences what the World Bank does. The World Bank AIDS programs are perfectly happy to use condoms and other prevention techniques and not just rely on abstinence, because the point here is simply that the White House in Washington gets to choose the president of the World Bank, but that's sort of where its big fiat ends. And after the president is chosen, he then reports to a board which consists of all these different shareholders. And the institution is full of staff drawn from all around the world. There's a slight American bias in terms of where they were trained, and it's an English-speaking institution. But nonetheless, it's not the patsy of Washington. And if there are areas where the U.S. administration is pushing policies that seem sort of technically misguided, the World Bank often pushes back, and the World Bank criticizes U.S. policies on agricultural subsidies, for example, which are bad for developing countries. So it's not kind of under the thumb to that extent.
Kirill, thanks for the call. And here's an email from Sam Connect in Wichita, Kansas. I have yet to hear a rational argument for forgiving third world debt other than they can't afford to repay their loans. And he says that's not an argument for forgiving. Can an argument be provided? And what happens with new loans to the forgiven third world countries? Will they be coming back in a few years asking once again for forgiveness? Joseph Stiglitz?
Well, I think there are different categories of arguments for forgiveness. One of them is a category of debts called odiose debts, where, for instance, when the United States or the World Bank, IMF, lent money to Mobutu in Zaire, they knew that the money was going into Swiss bank accounts. They knew that the people were not benefiting from that. Why should the people of Congo, Zaire, pay for these Cold War loans that the lender knew were not going to help the people? There's a whole long-standing doctrine on a legal argument on odiose debts, and I think many of the debts we're talking about fall in that category. The United States used that argument indirectly in talking about why the debts for why Iraq should be having debts forgiven, debts that were incurred by Saddam over the years. There's another argument, though, that I think is fundamentally that these countries can't really start to grow unless the debt burden is reduced. There's something fundamentally wrong with the way much of the global financial system works, where the burden of risk of interest rate and exchange rate fluctuations is imposed on the developing countries, so that even when they follow reasonable economic policies, events can happen that the debts are beyond their ability to repay. We have bankruptcy provisions in the United States and most advanced industrial countries when those kinds of contingencies arise. The lenders have a responsibility to make sure that these countries don't get in a mess again and to be prudent in their lending.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to you both. Joseph Stiglitz, thanks for the time today. Joseph Stiglitz is professor of finance and economics at Columbia University, former chief economist at the World Bank. Sebastian Mallaby, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Sebastian Mallaby, a columnist for The Washington Post and author of The World's Banker. When we come back from a short break, ready or not, we'll be talking about indigent defense.